Alrighty, so we're at week 3 in the thought of Augustine, and we're at his Confessions, one of the two really famous works of Augustine. In fact, if you've never read any of Augustine, perhaps you've still heard of the Confessions in the City of God. This is one that's easier to read than the City of God, at least in terms of its length, and therefore a lot of people who are not even Christians have read this book, or in the past been forced to read this book, and now you'll be forced to read the opposite of this book in public school. But it used to be a time when people would read such books in school. But now to the Confessions. It was 10 years. I have a timeline here. You see over there on the left, 386, representing his conversion, and 395, his appointment in Hippo. Those are the two dates that matter, alongside of the authorship of this book, which he wrote in Hippo. But it was 10 years since his baptism, and 2 years since he took the bishop's position in Hippo Regius. So he'd been a pastor for a couple of years, sharing that position, but 2 since he became the bishop of the whole city. And if you want to just remember what that means, in the first couple centuries, of course, bishop comes from the Greek word episkopos, and it's one of the words that the New Testament uses interchangeably with shepherd and presbyter. And so one of the ways that it became interpreted is sort of a pastor of pastors, a pastor of a whole region. And there's biblical ways you can kind of search out sort of a thing. And then there's what most of the church has done by that, which is unbiblical usages of that word. But at any rate, Augustine was sort of a bishop of the whole region of that part of North Africa in the West. And so it was the year 397. He was 43 years old when he found himself in the midst of his busy pastoral duties, compelled to write what he called My Confessions in 13 books. The first 9 chapters are autobiographical. Might not be the sort of autobiography you think of today. So you could, this is not the way my outline is, sort of is. It's a different way to put my outline. But the first 9 books, 1 through 9, are straight autobiography. And I suppose for a lot of people, that might be the part they can stomach. Although even there, people think, oh, this guy's just really hard on himself. And if I take this seriously, I'm going to be in a loony bin. And then books 10 through 13, which doesn't make any sense to anybody unless you're a philosopher. And that's sort of his philosophical investigations. Now, in my outline, I'm going to call these by different names. But anyway, that's how it breaks down. Books 1 through 9, autobiography. Books 10 through 13, philosophical, which of course doesn't mean that you won't find any philosophizing going on in books 1 through 9 and that you won't find anything autobiographical in 10 through 13. But that's how the book would be broken down, if you're interested. And we get a mission statement of sorts in book 2. And this is not the only time Augustine does this. He does it at least 2, I think maybe even 3 other times, when he basically tells you why he's writing this. But when he does, you have to understand he's not talking primarily to you, he's talking secondarily to you, he's talking to God. So the whole thing is kind of a meditation, which really causes stumbling over here when you get to the philosophical. He's still talking to God. That was pretty common, that people would actually, when they said meditation in the Western world, we didn't mean the Eastern thing, which we now do, and then we criticize the West for using the word, because it's their word, which shows you that we're completely backwards. Meditation just used to mean thinking hard about stuff. Now it means orange jumpsuit, levitation, metaphysical section of the bookstore, which shows you that you don't even know the meaning of that word, metaphysical. But at any rate, that's what he's doing. He's talking to God about stuff that matters, which I highly recommend, that you talk to God about something rather than nothing. Okay, well, Augustine says this. He says, "But to whom am I telling this story? Not to you, my God, rather in your presence I am relating these events to my own kin, the human race, however few of them may chance upon these writings of mine. And why? So that whoever reads them may reflect with me on the depths from which we must cry out to you." So we divide our notes into 2 parts here. I said I have my own words for this. So first section is going to be what I call Christian introspection. So in a sense, he's turning inward. But only so that he can then, again, turn outward and upward. So our second section is going to be Christian investigation. which is not where you depart from God's presence to do your philosophy, but where you turn up the heat of your rigor in your prayers. So from Christian introspection to Christian investigation, those are our two parts. Those are the places we're going today, and they mirror that breakdown of the confessions. Now, on a personal note, I first read the confessions in 1999 when I was first few weeks in my Christian walk. And it was formative for me. Both the introspection of Augustine and the investigation of Augustine provided what I think was a biblical anchor for me in an otherwise sea of experientialism, because I think, as you know, I've told you before, it was a very experientialist church. It was a charismatic church. Now, I had a background in philosophy and Christian theology before that. So you say, what were you even doing there? And, you know, maybe you don't know this, I don't know. When you become a new Christian, you're really, you know, your strength is your weakness. You're really vulnerable to, I don't know, jumping on a cultic bus. Because you're just so happy to be saved, and the people that are there with you, you'll be their PR guy. You'll be like their White House spokesman. It doesn't matter what sort of, and I'm not saying they were all bad. There were some strong, good, healthy things about that church, but I think all the more temptation then to sort of, whitewash it and think that they're just pure gold in everything they're saying and doing. And so there's a series of books that I was reading that summer that I think God used to provide an anchor for me to, not that I was ever going to gravitate into anti-intellectualism, but certainly gave me an idea of how you can think about your inner experience, and then make that ultimately about something outside of yourself, and not simply about your feelings or your emotional highs and stuff like that. But anyway, just a little personal bio on me. I've gotten a chance to reread it, look at some of my notes from 1999. That's always fun. You look at your notes in the margins and say, wow, you are A, an idiot, and B, God was upholding you. All right, so let's look at this. Christian introspection. And let's draw a little picture here. This represents the soul. Giant head, because he's a member of Western civilization, and he's oppressing people. So there's a giant head. But he's pointing outward. Okay, and so this is going to be, this little line here is going to make a distinction, which I'll return to later. But Augustine's going to go, he's going to go inward. And you can criticize him for that if you want to. Aha, that's where he finds truth. Inside, that's not where he's going. And you won't get that sense from Augustine. But he is going to explore his past. He's going to explore his sin. And he's going to explore his memory and his thoughts and stuff like that. And he's doing so talking to God, giving praise to God the whole time. And so he is, in pointing inward, he is only doing that to point outward. Okay? And so that's going to give us the flow. But the first few books are really, really interesting. They trace his life. For some of you, maybe it goes slow. But I think you'll find it interesting because, first of all, he starts at infancy. If I was to ask you, where does Augustine start here in this biography? Where would you start in a biography? You'd probably, I mean, you might tell where your parents came from and stuff like that, but by and large, you wouldn't talk much about your infancy because, you know, you don't remember it. But Augustine, here's what he does. He looks at other babies and he says, look at them. I mean, the only reason they're not killing you is because they can't, but they really want to. They want to strangle you. Okay, he doesn't quite say it like that, but his point is, and he's not deducing his whole doctrine of depravity from just observation. He has biblical truth behind that, he's reasoning, but he talks about his infancy, and he's giving praise to God for carrying him through that, for uniting him to his mother, and through her to his first inklings of truth, and stuff like that. And you're like, that's really weird, but if you read it, I think you'll find there's a lot of insight to it. He goes from that to higher education, but in the midst of doing that, as his mother, Monica, who I said was a Christian, and his father, they did agree on one thing, and that was a good education. They wanted to get their kids out of that region where they would make nothing of themselves, and Augustine, of course, took that to be worldly ambition, and that became for him very quickly worldly ambition. But he does recount a couple things from his childhood and then his teenage years. They're interesting. Two things that are very famous in the early going of the Confessions. One, where he's talking about the nature of sin from this one particular act that he and his friends participated in. They stole a bunch of pears. You say, who cares about that? Yeah, beat yourself up over that. And it's funny because the first time I heard that, I had just done something similar with my friends, except they were apples. And we thought they were apples. We thought they were actually baseballs, which is why we took them. So we thought we were making a killing. But anyway, Scott left his trunk open. I don't know why I'm recounting this to you right now, except for the fact that we did it for the same reason that Augustine did it. Because he said, I wasn't going to make a profit on this. I did it for the sheer pleasure of stealing. And that's a problem. Because C.S. Lewis takes so much of his view of good and evil from Augustine. And Lewis makes the point, and Augustine would agree, and I think it's right, that we never really do anything for the pure end of evil. Even, you know, robbing a bank or whatever else is done for some good thing in the wrong way. So, for example, security. Security is good in and of itself, but we pluck that from God's goodness and His glory and so forth. And I think that's absolutely true. But there's a stop on that bus to, or if you go that direction, where there is a pleasure taken in the evil as well. I think those two truths can be reconciled. But Augustine recounts that, and you respond wrongly if you say, my goodness, you were 12, you were 15. I don't think he tells you how old he was. Why are you beating yourself up over this? And one of the reasons is because we're still doing the same things. We're still sinning in that way. We're still doing it for those reasons. Other things he recounts has to do with his growing awareness of the opposite sex. And he doesn't come off as somebody who is overly obsessed with it. He seems pretty normal, actually, which is another thing that you might want to keep in mind when you hear the critics of Augustine talk about that issue. But, you know, typical stuff. He was being driven by his father in certain ways in that direction to get married or whatever else. And he's going through that, again, he doesn't have to beat himself up over these things because it's manifestly evil the way he talks about it. But at any rate, he recounts shameful acts like these, the sheer love of theft, his struggles with lust, his vain motives for studying. The candor is legendary. He even confesses to some specific forms of lust that happened long after conversion, wrestling with the shame of sensuality even in dreams. And in all this, he says to God that, quote, you sprinkled bitter gall over my sweet pursuits. Kind of the same language of Hosea in Hosea chapter 2. That God was the one giving food and clothing to this bride while she was playing the prostitute in order to break her of it, to break her supply lines ultimately and to bring her back. At every point, Augustine doesn't simply reminisce, but he traces the markings of providence and grace. And the author never misses the chance to offer up praise to God for each step, to show that even at the depths of depravity, there was a longing. Perverted as it was, and all the more blameworthy because of that longing had been planted in him by God, a desire for himself. And so Augustine said, you have made us for yourselves, and our hearts are restless until they find their rest in you. I think that's another lesson, is that we don't laugh about our past sins. We don't say, yeah, but I'm saying that's behind me. Ha, ha, ha. Look at me back then. Because, one reason, because there is no time to God. In other words, time doesn't heal the wound of sin. If sin is healed, it is by it being placed on the substitute and punished in Him. But our sins are ever before the face of God. And so we don't look back and say, well, that was then. Well, that was an infinite crime then, worthy of a punishment of infinite duration. And therefore, time does not solve that. The picture of Augustine's days of study is a vivid display of the folly of merely secular pursuits. Both the master and the student are made the fool in this recollection. There's some great quotes in there. When he's studying at Thagaste, his hometown, and then Carthage, where he's first going to these schools of rhetoric, he's studying Virgil's Aeneid, for example, what our kids just study, recounting how, you know, if this is the highest you can go, this God doing this particular thing, you should be locked up for doing stuff like that. And yet, we were praised for praising it. We were mutually scratching each other's back on our way to hell, in a sense. And these perverts, you know, Augustine paints this picture of a kind of pervert of the intellect. In other words, Anybody who's teaching any subject for any other reason but to bring glory and honor to God and to unite in the student's mind and heart all the different subjects around God's glory. Such another person would be a pervert, a child molester, in a sense. Despising Greek, but very much attracted to the Latin authors, the study of rhetoric was the means by which he could achieve notoriety. And so there's a lot on worldly ambition. And he rejects wealth, even as a pagan. But not out of pure motives. For him, prestige was even greater than wealth. And for him, it was a particular prestige. It was not a political prestige. He could have taught rhetoric for a couple of years, and who goes to schools of rhetoric in Rome? The movers and shakers in the world. So that's just a stepping stone that you can then, you know, get involved in the politics yourself. So while he was rejecting that, he wasn't doing it for the right motives. He wanted to be a philosophical guru. His own summary of why he fell in with the Manichaeans involves three pieces of ignorance. And if you were here in week one, we talked about what Manichaeanism was. It was during these years, between the 370s and the mid-380s, for 11 years that he was in this movement, really knowing deep down inside that they don't have the ultimate answers, but this is the best I can do, which is, you know, really, talk to your atheistic friends. This is pretty much the best they can do in many cases. So his own summary, he said, three pieces of ignorance. I was being subtly maneuvered into accepting the views of those stupid deceivers, but that's not very nice. Those stupid deceivers, by the questions they constantly asked me about the origin of evil. I did not know that evil is nothing but the diminishment of good to the point where nothing at all is left. Nor did I know that God is spirit. I did not know either that inward righteousness takes as its criterion, not custom, but the most righteous law of Almighty God. End quote. There's a lesson for you. False doctrine ruins your life. You can waste 11 years or 80 because you don't know that God is spirit or know what you mean when you say that. By not knowing such things, we're not talking about secondary things. We're talking about the very nature of God and the nature of salvation. By not knowing that, your entire life and the life of everybody within miles of you can be utterly destroyed. This is the way Western man used to think, even those who were wrong about the ultimate things. They were at least more right than most Christians today who would tell you that such things don't matter at all. His post in Milan did not settle him into superiority complex. In fact, he was constantly shaken. He was constantly speculating, but he knew deep down inside that he didn't have the ultimate questions. Some of his insights are very interesting. And, you know, I have to do this somewhat randomly. I had to choose which things to include and which things not to. Here's one thing that I found interesting. In a statement that I think would have utterly surprised Ayn Rand, who apparently didn't realize that there were Christians before her that had thought of some of the things that she took to be insurmountable objections against the Christian faith. But here's one. The student, Augustine, while he was still a student, came to see the vicious irrationality of altruism. And Rand's chief reason for rejecting anything that she rejected was that it was altruism, the philosophy that I will be nice to you by dropping dead. You can take all my stuff. That's not helping the other person. Well, she thought that Christianity taught that. Well, in her day, and in fact in our day still, a lot of Christians do teach that and misunderstand the Bible in that light. Well, Augustine said this, quote, "A person who sorrows for someone who is miserable earns approval for the charity that he shows. But if he is genuinely merciful, he would far rather there were nothing to be sorry about. If such a thing as spiteful benevolence existed," which is impossible, of course, but supposing it did, "a genuinely and sincerely merciful person would wish others to be miserable so that he could show them mercy. We must conclude that while some sorrow is commendable, no sorrow is to be valued for its own sake." Man, it's like Augustine had a bunch of communists for friends. He knew them very well. That's exactly right. Augustine would have surely condemned the dehumanizing collectivism of the modern world that measures love by how much you can simply redistribute of the existing pie, no matter what the growth or diminishment of their souls will be. While we're in it, we should ask how Augustine would have understood the ego in general, how he would have understood the pleasure principle in particular. In other words, in specific, how would have Augustine understood the ministry of, say, John Piper? Would he have recognized his own view in the view of Christian hedonism? And, while we're at it, if he were reading Ayn Rand, and if she were still alive, let's say they're both still alive, because neither one of them is still alive, but what would he have said to her to say, no, you misunderstand. We're not against the ego. What we're against is this, and so forth. Well, you can get a sense of what Augustine would have said about the ego and about the pleasure principle by asking him what pride is. Augustine, what is pride? He would have said this, quote, and this is in Book 10, Part 59 of the Confessions. He says, this is the temptation to want veneration and affection from others, and to want them not for the sake of some quality that merits them, but in order to make such admiration itself the cause of my joy. So in other words, the desire of veneration from others, the attention from others, you say, well, what are you going to point them to? Doesn't matter. Well, then, how do you know it will be good for their soul? I hadn't thought about that. Okay, so the problem with pride is not too much goodness going on, too loud, too high of a bar. That's not what pride is. Pride is not glory-seeking per se. Think of Romans 2:7. To those who seek for glory, what do they get? Dunce caps sit in the corner, they haven't been humble enough? No, they get eternal life, Paul says. Pride is not glory-seeking per se. Nor is pride the love of self which is moved for the greatest good of the self, which is why Jesus says in John 12, if you hate yourself in this life, you will find it for eternal life. Now, John's Gospel in John 12 adds a little bit more to that passage than the Synoptic Gospels do about if you love your life, if you lose your life, you'll gain it. If you gain your life, I always butcher that. I can't help myself. But John's Gospel adds that qualification, which is not a contradiction to the other Gospels. It's just more information. Jesus is saying, this is real life. Seek that. Self-sacrifice is not an end in itself, even for Jesus. Hebrews 12:2 and other places. Read all the Piper stuff. You'll get that. It is not glory-seeking. It is not love of self, being moved for the good of the self. Since that connection between the self and the greatest glory make up the whole language of Scripture. There's a worldly ambition, and there is an eternal ambition. Because there is a corrupting value, and there is an incorruptible value. And the Bible appeals to our desire for an incorruptible value. Back to the bio for a second. It's clear that Augustine, by 386, as he's in Milan, he's listening to the sermons of Ambrose. It's pretty clear when he first started listening to Ambrose, as his mother Monica had been praying for him for years, this impossible prayer, as he's ascending to one of the greatest intellects in the world, but now she's finally got him in church with her. Because he can hear the sermons of somebody who knows what he's talking about. Lesson, again. But as he's listening, he is listening with the same vain fascination as, say, Benjamin Franklin or David Hume sat listening to the sermons of George Whitefield. They admire the eloquence. And he said, quote, I hung keenly upon his words, but cared little for their content. Nonetheless, as his words, which I enjoyed, penetrated my mind, the substance, which I overlooked, seeped in with them. For I could not separate the two. As I opened my heart to appreciate how skillfully he spoke, the recognition that he was speaking the truth crept in at the same time, though only by slow degrees. There's another lesson. Flip that coin around and play some secular music. Now, there's a dumb way to argue this, as generations of fundamentalists have done since time immemorial, or at least until drums came around. I don't know when they started arguing this. But anyway, but there's a truth, too. And here's the truth. Don't focus on the... Don't play the role of the superstitious, I'm afraid of drums. Okay, don't do that. Because you'll play right into the devil's hand. But it just so happens that the human soul, much less an adolescent, who's being told by our whole culture that acting like a monkey is what we do for these 5 years, and we'll call it adolescence, even though no culture in the history of humanity has ever done that. You're an adult and you're 13, or I kick you and throw you in jail. Act like a human at 13, or I will bury you alive in a box. That's pretty much the message of parents everywhere, until we came around and we created this thing called adolescence. 5 years, act like a monkey, here's some stuff on MTV for you, a little bit of sugar on top of it. Your kids are not capable. You're not capable of separating the medium and the message. Music plays to the affections. Poetry, literature, blinking stuff on TV especially, the less active you are, the more it bypasses the intellect. All the more reason why you're in danger in not taking this in proactively. So the less proactive the artistic form, it is not the case that therefore there's nothing to worry about. It's just the opposite. The less proactive you are taking this stuff in, the more susceptible you are to it. Well, God wired preaching that way too. He knows very well that people are going to show up to church because there's some girl in the choir. And then he gets you with a preacher who's actually preaching the word. And so this stuff seeps in, as he says about Ambrose's preaching. Side note, there was some speculation that the confessions were a manifesto of his own conversion. His appointment to Hippo was not without controversy. The town at that time gloried in a certain amount of anti-intellectualism. So yes, in northern Africa, there were those that went to Carthage to be lovers of eloquence and lovers of themselves and so on and so forth. But among the townspeople, there was a tradition in Hippo of gathering themselves to themselves presbyters who were not as smart as, say, the engineers and the so on and so forth, the townspeople. And so they could easily hold themselves above the messengers. Well, then they said, okay, we'll fix you. We'll get the master teacher of rhetoric in the world right now who just got saved, and we're going to make him your pastor. And so, well, that was good news for people that were hungry for the word, but for people who were not, they couldn't play that game anymore. And so one thing they could do, perhaps, was to question Augustine's conversion, the genuineness of it. And so some people have speculated that the confessions were written at least partially to an apologia for his own conversion. To say, no, this is my faith. This is kind of like a creed. This is who I am. This is what I'm thinking. Well, that's speculation. Back to his conversion. It was while reconciling the writings of the Platonists with the letters of Paul, when he and his main fellow traveler, Alypius, who you'll hear him write about, he's on the same journey with him, and they were reading through Romans 13. They were reading through the whole book of Romans, but they got up to Romans 13, and he's in his mother's living room with Alypius, Bible open, and he suddenly bursts out, what is happening to us? What does this mean? The untaught are rising up and taking heaven by storm, while we, with all our dreary teachings, are still groveling in the world of flesh and blood. So he was overcome with frustration over his own sin. And then tears. And then he excused himself outside to the garden of the house, and lost in conviction, he overheard the sing-song chant as children played in the yard next to them. Tole lege, tole lege, which means take up and read, take up and read. And he took that to be a message from God, returned to the couch, picked up in the verse where they had left off, where Paul said in Romans 13, verse 13 and 14, let us walk properly, as in the daytime, not in orgies and drunkenness, not in sexual immorality and sensuality, not in quarreling and jealousy, but put on the Lord Jesus Christ and make no provision for the flesh to gratify its desires. Now, why that particular passage? Well, he doesn't explicitly say, but if you see the context, you can see what the struggle is. Because in classical philosophy, the gaining of self-control, the virtue of self-control, so as to not be a mere animal, in other words, to not be a creature of time, but to ascend above that, was a pretty huge deal. But it was personal for him. He says, in that place of the confessions, "Late have I loved you, beauty so ancient and so new. Late have I loved you. Lo, you were within, but I outside, seeking there for you. And upon the shapely things you have made, I rushed headlong, I misshapen. You were with me, but I was not with you." In book 9, the end of the biographical section, it closes the book on Monica's life of prayer for him with her death and his grief. And much like C.S. Lewis, when recounting his own conversion and his own desperate need, when he does that, he conceives of things in very monergistic terms. So he says in that place in book 10, or at the end of book 9, "Give what you command, and then command whatever you will. For it is already a mark of wisdom to recognize whose gift this is." That was that famous prayer that Pelagius heard and said, "Ah, what's that?" And we'll get back to that in a future week. But Christian investigation, books 10 through 13, take up speculation on subjects such as memory, that's book 10, time and eternity, that's book 11, heaven and earth, that's book 12, and the biblical accounts of creation and prophecy of the Messiah to come, that's book 13. First is to memory, and I'll only get to two of these for today, just ran out of time. Memory. Why is he doing this? Why is he making this touching description of his conversion and then the death of Monica and his thanks to God for all of it, and then he gets all academic on us? Well, not quite. First of all, it does look like that, though. Augustine gives us a beginning to a second-order epistemology here in memory. What do I mean by second-order epistemology? Well, epistemology is the study in philosophy of how you know and how you know that you know. And the problem in so much of modern Western philosophy, and unfortunately the church that has lapped up its polluted stream down in the cesspool of culture, is that we've lost the primary meaning of the study of epistemology, which is after truth criterion. In other words, something objective. In other words, up here, at the height of epistemology, the whole reason the question exists is because we don't care how you know, if by that you mean, where did you come to hear that? I don't give a rip. And you shouldn't give a rip about where I got it from. That is a very short step to the ad hominem fallacy in logic. In other words, tell me where you got that. I'll see if I care. And if I don't, I'll tell you how the only reason I ought to believe that you're telling me is because you heard it from so-and-so. Okay? So it becomes a form of dismissal. So the question, how do you know, had better mean, how do you know that you know? Okay? I'm not after something subjective, which is interesting, but that could just be the natural history of knowledge. Your knowledge in your own head, or a certain group of people, a certain civilization. It could be cognitive science. It could be psychology. All interesting, all legitimate studies. But that's not how we know that we know. Describing the monkey-like motions in a particular finite mind is not sufficient evidence, much less logic. What we're after is an objective reason why all must bow the knee to this particular truth. It is not enough to have epistemic permission to believe something and not be laughed at by the skeptics. Not good enough. We want epistemic imperialism to a lot of people, but a demand, a law, that everybody ought to say, we ought to believe this. It is manifestly true. And Romans 1:20 makes it very clear that the truth of God is so clear to everybody that they are without excuse. Epistemology is treated in Scripture like a judicial issue. When you go before the courts of God on Judgment Day, you will not be able to say what Bertrand Russell thought he would say when somebody asked him, what will you say when you go before God on Judgment Day? And he said, you didn't give me enough evidence. Paul says, not true. They are without excuse. You will not be able to say that. So there's a first order of epistemology. I know I'm going on a rant here, but I'm just trying to tell you what second order of epistemology is and why Augustine was doing it. First order epistemology is truth criteria, objective laws that stand over everyone by which we measure everything. That doesn't mean we don't care about this. We may be interested for many reasons. How you know. For example, by finding out how you know, I can be a better preacher. I can be a better evangelist. I can be a better parent. Because then I'm looking into your mind and saying, that's how that works. So I can start getting out the toolbox of my words and so on. And this is very important. We're not devaluing this. We're just saying that's not primarily what epistemology is. Having said all that, Augustine is writing this portion on memory, giving us a beginning of a second order epistemology. And it is sophisticated. It would have had no trouble keeping up with the empiricist accounts in the modern world of how we think about things. So he says, quote, "The sense impressions themselves," in other words, my impressions taken through primarily sight, but hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, "the sense impressions themselves do not find their way in, however. It is the images of things perceived by the senses that are available there to the person who recalls them." Why does this matter to theism? Because if this is the catalyst and the engine for knowledge, atheism might have a point. However, in here, even of those things that arise from the world, which is mostly, how do you know everything? My mommy told me. Primary colors. If touch stove, therefore ow. You know, you go all the way back to infancy, and you see that there is a kind of priority given to sense impressions. But Augustine would say, okay, let's assume that even. Let's assume that everything you know comes in through the five senses. Let's just assume that for the sake of argument. Now, what are these things? Kant was not the first person to have this insight. Sure, everything comes in this way, but there has to be something here that's primary in another sense. We didn't need Kant to tell us that. Augustine was already on it in this quote right here. "They are not sense impressions that are those things in your mind. The images perceived by the senses are the things that are there in the mind." Now, why is Augustine doing this? Why is he searching himself? Shouldn't he have gotten over this already, this inward turn? At first glance, we might confuse this transition from introspection in the first part to higher investigation. We might confuse that with the narcissist's inward turn. Certainly, as I've already pointed out in week one and before in this class, Michael Horton, for one Reformed theologian, has confused this with mysticism and rationalism. Any insight, an inward turn away from God's voice to private, I see things. That's arrogant. It is works righteousness. It is isolated from the community and so on and so forth. And at that point, Horton sounds a lot like N.T. Wright. They're perfectly at one on this revolt against Western thinking. But at any rate, at first it might look like an inward turn. Here's why he's doing it. Augustine is only looking at the soul so as to polish off the lens outward and upward. So let me add to this chart a couple of things which I hope you will recognize right away as cardinal truths for theism. I'm going to put soul inside this circle. I'm going to maintain this invisible line separating the invisible above, the visible below. We could call this up here the spiritual. Could call this down here the material. Not saying spiritual good, material bad. That really is Gnosticism. But if I was to ask you, Christianity 101, would you say spiritual above material? So, oh, sure, yeah. Not above like, you know, when Jesus ascended, he went that way above. But above certainly transcendent, superior too, right? Everybody would say, sure, I'll buy that. Good. Let me add one more thing to this chart.
around this circle shaping the soul, I'm going to put the word rational. Below the line, kind of in the same circle around this being, this thing called a person, and it's a finite person. We're not talking about God, because God does not have a body. We're not talking about Christ in the incarnation either at this point. We're just talking about his image bearer. Where I put rational up here, I'm going to put empirical down here. And the kids in astronomy, and they'll continue to learn in philosophy as we move on to the modern thought next year, are learning what the word empirical means. Knowledge gained by observation, experimentation, and experience with the material world. And it's transmitted through sense data. We don't disagree that sense data is a perfectly fine term for those impressions as they come into me. However, if I'm going to maintain the superiority of this up here over this down here, then I must maintain the superiority of this in here over this out there. Does everybody understand that? Because if you don't, you're vulnerable to atheistic arguments, which are second-rate bad arguments. But that, nevertheless, if you get duped by Christian books saying, that's Gnosticism, that's dualism, so you're saying the body is not necessary to the soul? Well, in one sense we are saying that, but we don't have to then therefore conclude that God's design is ever that the body would be without the soul, nor that the body is in any sense bad. We're not saying that. It's a straw man. Okay? But in order to maintain the superiority of the spiritual over the material, I must maintain the superiority of the rational over the empirical. If I don't do that epistemologically, rational over the empirical, I can't do this metaphysically or theologically, the spiritual over the material. Because who else does this but souls, but rational agents, resisting the so-called superiority of the empirical? That's why he's doing it. He is showing the superiority of the rational soul over the empirical in particular, in order to show the superiority of the spiritual over the material in general. But we may suffer from the disadvantage of the advantage applied to our own selves. You know, despising the familiar. We learn to despise ourselves, ironically. We who love ourselves in a sinful way. We learn to despise ourselves by familiarity with ourselves, so that we render the human soul inadmissible in the court of ultimate reality. But in fact, it's a constant miracle. Now, it's not entirely clear whether Augustine's second order epistemology is a kind of idealist thing or what it is. There's some comments he makes that make you think, man, he really is, I think, maybe taking this too far. For example, he says, what I have stowed away in my memory is not the images of these things, but the things themselves. And at first when I read that, I thought, ah, he's embracing a kind of idealism. In other words, all is idea. But then that's going to, and that could go in the same direction of Jonathan Edwards. But the problem with it is that this is the real thing, not this out here. And therefore, you're going to lose objectivism there. So if this is the real thing in here, person one, well then person two is going to have the real thing. And is it the same thing? And if it's not, well then this guy's his own independent reality, and that's ultimate. And that guy's got his own, but that's not what Augustine's saying. If you read him charitably and keep reading and pressing through, it's not where he's going. He continues. When we learn things which are not imbibed through the senses as images, but are known directly in their own reality inside the mind, as they are in themselves, and without the intervention of images, in other words, physical images, we are collecting by means of our thought those things which memory already held, but in a scattered and disorderly way. So, here's what I believe he's saying, and if he isn't, then I'll correct him. Happy to do that. I'm not defending Augustine for Augustine's sake here. When he says, when we behold things, our mind is beholding the thing itself, and what we see, for example, see that chart? In a tree is not the thing itself, by which he does not mean that this is the object and our goal is to conform ourselves to the object. He agrees with that.
But if you were to ask him, what is a tree? Augustine would not go over to the tree, pick up a leaf and say, that. Okay, that, alright, that's an example of a tree. But what's the essence of a tree? Okay, that's a leaf, that's part of a tree. So what's a leaf then? He would not say, take a closer look and rub it into your eye. Because you would still say, well, that's an example of a leaf. But what am I looking at here? Take away greenness. And is green not still a thing? Sure it is, right there. That's not a leaf. Or what about leafiness? You know, and go on and on and on and on. What he's saying is, if you really want to know what this thing is, of course that is the thing, and we don't get to determine what it is. That's objectivism. On the other hand, in order to have objectivism, you need a kind of superiority of the rational. This is the arena, the mind, that I can tell you what the thing in itself is. And so Augustine here is siding with the Apostle Paul against Immanuel Kant and the whole modern world and saying, no, we can know the thing in itself. But knowing a thing in itself is not done with the fingers or the nose or even the physical hamburger in here that we call the brain. Knowing a thing in itself is always a property of the invisible mind, seeing the invisible things of God. They are always, at every point, rational things, invisible things, eternal things, things of the mind. So what matters in this whole thing about memory is that the mind, not the senses, is the real beholder of the object that is. Even the objective essence of a physical thing like a tree. But there's another path to God through memory. There's another religious reason, spiritual reason, that Augustine is probing through memory. There's a path to God there, he suspects. What about happiness? What is happiness, he asks, that all people seek for it without exception? He says it seems that, quote, these would not so strongly desire happiness unless they possessed it in some degree. In other words, you don't go after a thing that you don't already remember the sense in which it will satisfy you. You have to at least know something about it to pursue it. Even if you're mistaken about it, that mistake will be about something real that you thought would make you happy. In other words, the happy life cannot be corporeal. It cannot be corruptible. It cannot be an object of knowledge per se. It has to be more than that. These are apprehended, but they're no longer longed for. In other words, do we have a memory of happiness? Whether it's a memory from our childhood, or whether it's a memory in Adam, so to speak. You know, Adam transmitted his sin to us. He transmitted his death to us. He transmitted his guilt to us. Did he perhaps also transmit the memory of happiness to us? Some speculation. Pascal wasn't the first person to have this insight. The two different people, with seemingly totally different ends, both possess a common chief end in happiness. This insight was first Augustine's. In other words, the person that goes to war, the person that tries to avoid war, in other words, the war hawk and the pacifist, on the surface, totally different ends. Not true. What you are seeing are totally different means to the same chief end. The person that goes to war and the person that seeks to avoid war are both doing exact opposite things on the surface in order to be ultimately happy. They are employing what look to the world like ultimate chief ends, but really are subordinate ends to the chief end to be happy. But that creates a dilemma for Augustine in the ultimate end. He says, we cannot therefore assert without qualification that everybody wants to be happy, because people who are unwilling to find joy in you, in which alone the happy life consists, obviously do not want the happy life. Perhaps, though, all men and women do want it. But by reason of the struggle of flesh against spirit and spirit against flesh, which hinders them from doing what they want to do, they fall back on what their strength permits and make do with that. The strength there being moral inability. They are unable, they are not strong enough to really want to not die. But whether we're speaking of the intellectual apprehension of God's nature, or whether we're speaking of the affectionate pursuit of God's happiness, Augustine is planting his flag in mind and memory for a very good reason, which the modern world has done its best to erase in us. He says, I have not found you outside of my memory, for I have discovered nothing about you that I did not remember from the time I learned to know you." You say, you have not found God in anywhere but your own mind? He doesn't mean what you think he means. And this is going to be the fundamental hurdle between us and our own intellects that the church, unfortunately, has set up in concert with the modern world. All biblical truth is stored, processed, staged in mind and memory alone. You will not learn anything about God apart from your mind. What about Scripture alone? Okay? Where's the Bible? Stop me when I've learned something. Well, you can't do it, can you? You know, when you think about it for 2 seconds, you might think you're probably thinking wrong. Because you won't learn anything from Scripture apart from your mind. And if the church spooks you away from that, you're going to be in a lot of trouble. It doesn't work by osmosis. It's not a physical, it's not a pill that goes through your bloodstream. Memory is both the great storehouse of God's Word and the treacherous playground of the devil. So even here, there is a pastoral, practical concern that Augustine has. There's no other way but the intellectual way here. Hey, Josh, can you get me a cup of water? Coffee plus chalk equals choking. So yeah, sin's possible. You know that, yeah. All right, good. Alright, last section, real quickly, is his reflections on time and eternity. Looks like he's going slow on purpose. Alrighty. Time and eternity, that's book 11. That's the last one we'll cover. Augustine doesn't have the same problem all your philosophy professors did, if you did listen to them or have them. He doesn't have the flat or the narrow absence of mind. There you go. That philosophy professors do when they think about time and eternity. Eternity is not conditioned by time. Eternity is not ignorant of time. To suppose one is to allow the other as well. To refuse to take them both together and to refuse to take eternity always as supreme over time is to fail to reckon with what either is. The first premise in Augustine's thinking here in this chapter is derived from a conclusion, and it goes like this. I think this quote is in your notes. It says, quote, "Heaven and earth plainly exist, and by the very fact that they undergo change and variation, they cry out that they were made. If anything was not made, yet exists, there is no element in it that was not present earlier. For change and variation imply that something is made that was not previously there." Again, do you believe in the law of identity? If you do, hopefully, one of the examples of it, one of the many examples of it, that you'll see about God in this case, is that immutability, in other words, not changing, equals, argues for, implies, immediately, analyze the term and you'll see that what you have is something uncaused. That's his whole point here. Then you can go further and say, therefore, no succession of moments. No temporal constraints. And so to be immutable is to transcend time. One implies the other for the reason that it gave. If anything is not made, so if it's in the category of not made, but it exists, there is no element in it that was not present earlier. And even the word earlier is problematic there. Augustine considers how God must have made everything ex nihilo, and by the word. In other words, out of nothing, by speaking it into existence. It was not an audible word, he thinks to himself, since the syllables are measured by succession and stimulates the eardrum, and then in a sense drops to the ground to nothingness. And that can't be the same as the eternal word. Such a word without succession must itself be eternally existent, and so must be God himself. So do you see that? Such an eternal word that has no succession must itself be God. Otherwise it would be a second thing which is either brought into existence or exist parallel to God. What is that? Two gods? No. And so Augustine reasons that this must be Christ, and remembers that the Word is constantly calling Him the Word, so that He is uttered eternally, he says. And it is at this point that he answers one of the pretty few, I'd say, understandable dilemmas offered by skeptical philosophy at first glance. And it's this: if God's will that creation should occur is eternal, why is creation not eternal as well? So do you understand the dilemma? If God's will is unchanging and therefore eternal, and God willed to create, never learning that He desired to create, why isn't creation then, and you could say it another way, why isn't creation then a part of God? Why? Well, this is the context of that famous question, what was God doing before creation? You run into it here in book 11. And you might be relieved to find out that Augustine actually directly refuses to answer this with that scornful, he was getting hell ready for people who inquisitively peer into deep matters. Augustine's quote then says, I'm not saying that. For this is to evade the force of the question. End quote. So Augustine thought it was a perfectly reasonable question. So how does he answer it? Well, his answer is this. It's all wrapped up in the idea that time is a creature. Time is a creature. So succession of moments is a creature, a created thing. The whole objection assumes that God decrees in succession. In other words, the objection only makes sense, only has a force, if you're assuming that a decree in God, in order to be unchanging, is in succession, requiring either ignorance or deliberation in order to will. So if God's unchanging desire is to create, then He never started to, He never had freedom to do otherwise. But you're assuming a lot of things about the necessity of God and the freedom of God being ignorance, because that's what it is in us. Decision implying learning that He wanted to. But you're assuming that our ignorance is the essence of freedom and knowledge and so forth. So here's what we do. We're full of ourselves and we project that on God and say, well, if He couldn't have done otherwise, well then, well, yet His will is also eternal. And so the answer is that God wasn't doing anything, if by doing you mean that doing requires bringing about what is not. Because either God brings about or He doesn't. If God brings about, then what you have is creation. If He does not, then He simply is, and nothing else is. So when you say, what was God doing before creation? You're assuming that the uncreated is in a before and an after and a so on to begin with. That's a false category. Time itself is a creature. So he says, quote, there was therefore never any time when you had not made anything, because you made time itself. And no phases of time are co-eternal with you, for you abide. And if they likewise were to abide, in other words, moments, they would not be time. For what is time? And there's the question that delivers the mail that even secular philosophers that are still opening up today. This is no easy question. Augustine admits as much. But let's start here. In what sense, to either, and this will be our last point, in what sense do either the past or the future have being? Present time seems the most elusive, and yet it is the one that's most like eternity. He says this, if that were always present and never slipped away into the past, it would not be time at all. It would be eternity. And the past no longer exists, and the future does not exist yet. In other words, we cannot really say that time exists except because it tends to non-being. And he says a little bit later on the same page, if we can conceive of a moment in time which cannot be further divided into even the tiniest of minute particles, that alone can be rightly termed the present. Yet even this flies by from the future into the past with such haste that it seems to last no time at all. Even if it has some duration, that too is divisible into past and future. Hence, the present is reduced to a vanishing point. Did you see the Truth Project? Remember how Dale Tackett did that? He said, so what is the present? You want to see it again? And he does that. And even that's an understatement. Because again, just like space, and you don't solve the question, well, this is Augustine just writing in the beginning of the 5th century. Modern physicists have come back to this because they realize that just to call, well, space is the same thing as time. Space-time continuum. It's the same curvature of physical space. That doesn't help because space has the same problem. Infinitely divisible. So it seems, on the surface. For Augustine's day, the movement of the heavenly bodies are not time either, but only markers of it. And he uses Hezekiah in that prayer to make that point. And this was in the era of classical astronomy, when such movements were widely understood and used for many practical purposes. So he says, when a body moves, I measure in terms of time how long it is in motion, from the moment when it began until it ceases motion, end quote. So clearly, we can't measure bodies in terms of time if time is that motion, for then all of our science would be an exercise in circular reasoning. It has to be measurement of that motion. It has to be outside of it. So perhaps Augustine says, time is tension of our consciousness. And in these thoughts, salvation is not seen to be an escape from time, as the Neoplatonists thought. It is proper to the creature. Augustine's not saying it's bad, it's good. Time is a dimension of the finite mind. But of God, even to speak of divine foreknowledge is a misnomer. Because, and you see this in Stephen Charnock much later on. The Puritans believe the same thing. They realize even foreknowledge is a loose term. Because of course we're not saying that God's over here and in foreseeing is foreseeing. So that he's foreseeing everything, but he needs his binoculars for that one and maybe a microscope for this one. That's a misnomer. God sees the whole perfectly. He is transtemporal, you might say. And anyway, in the last sections you have his thoughts on heaven and earth and the creation and prophecy. Arg. We've gone too long. Let's open it up to questions. Next week we'll talk about Augustine versus the Donatists.